This is the Talking Information Center, a window to independence through local volunteers reading over 300 newspapers, magazines, and books specific to your community.
Now available on your smart speaker by saying, play radio station Talking Information Center.
For comments and more information, call 781-834-4400 or visit ticnetwork.org.
Thank you for listening.
WBBF Middleborough, WRRS Middleborough, WRRSLP Pittsfield, WLOA Londonderry, WVALLP FL, WDJM Framingham.
Coming up next from the Talking Information Center, news stories from the Brockton Enterprise.
Hi, this is Brian, and we are reading the Enterprise for Wednesday, May 31st. The story, What to Do as a Breathalyzer Ruling Affects 27,000 People. District courts could soon be inundated with old drunk driving cases due to a recent ruling by the Supreme Judicial Court regarding the reliability of breathalyzer tests, a local attorney said. The courts could be overwhelmed because of this, said the attorney, Ernest Horn of Mendon. Horn, a former Mendon police chief, said there are several steps that those affected need to take before someone tries to overturn a case or withdraw a guilty plea. The court ruled that those who were convicted of drunk driving drunk during that period could be eligible to withdraw guilty pleas or have their convictions revisited. Up to 27,000 people are affected. They're going to want to speak to an attorney, and they can evaluate how it was handled, particularly if a breathalyzer was used, Horn said. Why are some breathalyzer results now invalid? Last month, the state's highest court ruled that all breathalyzer tests used between June 1, 2011 through April 18, 2019 had to be excluded from criminal prosecutions. An error was found in breathalyzer test calibrations that was discovered in 2019 is what led to the SJC's ruling. Should defendants withdraw guilty pleas and go to trial? Horn said drunken driving cases that did not involve a breathalyzer will not be affected, but he said if someone had pleaded guilty prior to trial due to a breathalyzer test coming in over the legal limit of 0.08, a judge would allow that defendant to withdraw the plea. That would put the case on the track for trial, and it would force prosecutors to find any witnesses for the cases, which could be difficult for the older cases. As people have moved, officers have retired, and people may not remember certain incidents. If a case had gone to trial and a defendant was found guilty, a lawyer would then evaluate whether the breathalyzer played a significant role in the conviction. If so, the defendant may want to petition to have the conviction overturned and to retry the case, Horn said. Drunken driving cases are often hard to prosecute without a breathalyzer test. It will effectively be impossible to prosecute these cases, Horn said. Attorney says retrial could hurt some defendants. Natick defense attorney Frank Doran does not believe it will be as cut and dry. He said many cases are not old enough for witnesses to have disappeared or retire, and a retrial could potentially lead to further punishment if the new presiding judge is stricter than the original judge. It's not a clear-cut answer, Doran said. It's like picking a scab. If you've already gone through it all, lost your license for 120 days, do you really want to go back and go through it again? Doran said the decision could be most helpful for those who are facing a subsequent offense. Punishments get more severe with each conviction, so having a previous drunk driving case overturned could have a benefit to a newer case by getting an offense removed. Getting rid of that first one could make a big difference, Doran said. Revisited OUI cases haven't reached courts yet. Framingham District Court Clerk Magistrate Robert Jubinville said the court has not yet seen an uptick in people appealing old drunken driving cases. He added that it will probably take several months before this occurs regularly. Jubinville, who was a governor's counselor for a decade before starting his clerk magistrate job in Framingham at the start of this year, said he does not know whether there will be a lot of people appealing guilty verdicts. A lot of these go back a number of years, he said. If you have a first offense, it's a misdemeanor. If you have your life back and your life going good, do you really want to go back and retry it? You run the risk of being found guilty again. Repeat drunk drivers have higher incentive to appeal. Jubinville agreed with the lawyers that people who have multiple drunken driving offenses are more likely to appeal. I think you'll see some people with third or fourth offenses who may try to get it overturned so they can get their license back, he said. Horn said it's still too early to determine the fallout. He said he has questions about people who paid fines or paid for classes due to faulty convictions or even served jail time. He said there could be civil cases that come from the decision. What will happen to all of these people who paid thousands of dollars for programs and probation costs? Are they going to be reimbursed, he said. What if they got 60 days or a year in the House of Corrections? Do you have a lawsuit you can bring? Suing the government is always difficult. I think we'll have a better idea of what's happening in a few months. Story: Plymouth resident builds, paints oversized chair as tourist attraction. Big chairs are big business for Plymouth's Corey Caranchi. The 34-year-old Plymouth resident is the carpenter and the artist behind the new 10-foot Adirondack chair in Shirley Square at the corner of Main and North Street. This is the second chair Caranchi has in town. His first is a yellow chair at Village Landing Marketplace on the waterfront. The Alice in Wonderland scale of the chair, along with its bright blue color and words touting Plymouth as America's hometown, is meant as a tourist attraction, but plenty of residents have already had their picture taken in the chair and posted it to social media over the last few days. Caranchi's work started about 3 years ago after seeing a similar oversized chair used for pictures at the Derby Street shops in Hingham. I saw that and thought I would build them to market to businesses, he said. I saw how much attraction the chair drew, and it's almost free marketing for a business. His first client, however, came from academia after Bridgewater State University ordered three, which were painted using the school's colors and logo. After that, it all just picked up from there, he said. He has since gone on to create chairs for businesses and others throughout the South Shore and Cape. His left brain, right brain talents in carpentry and art have been with him throughout his life. He is trained in metal fabrication and welding and studied carpentry in trade school. His artistic pursuits were more of a hobby, although his talents didn't go unrecognized in high school. I usually got an A-plus in art class, he said. He worked in the construction industry following his graduation. After working for a company for several years, Caranchi wanted something more. I realized there was not much potential there, he said. I had more creative things to offer, so I went out on my own. He has received so many orders since then that making and painting the chairs is his full-time job these days. Creation and installation of the chair came after a months-long process of searching for locations and applying for permits. The Downtown Waterfront Business District Association sponsored the chair. Association member and UVA Wine Bar co-founder Katie Thayer came across his works online and reached out to him about doing a chair for that downtown. What a great idea to get people up from the waterfront to have a photo op in the downtown area to help the businesses, she told the select board in a meeting earlier this month, during which the board signed off on the project. A lot of people think that downtown businesses are thriving in the summertime, but it's actually our slowest season because everyone is on the waterfront. As a Plymouth resident with his share of hometown pride, he was excited to take on the job. This was a special one to build, he said. To see if more Karanchi's work, search Giant Adirondack Chairs on Facebook. The story, Mother is Suing 110 Grill, says daughter suffered allergic reaction. In Braintree, a Braintree mother is suing the 110 Grill restaurant in Braintree for more than $500,000, alleging that her 17-year-old daughter suffered an allergic reaction while eating at the restaurant, according to court documents. In a complaint filed in Norfolk Superior Court, Haley Lopes said her daughter ate at the 110 Grill with her father and brother Aiden in October 2022. Aiden and his sister informed the waiter that they both suffer from life-threatening allergies to foods including peanuts, dairy, and eggs. The complaint states that when the waiter returned with an order of sweet potato fries for Lopes' daughter, who is not named in the lawsuit, he listed some of her allergies but omitted others. He then placed the burger in front of Aiden with an egg on top, according to the lawsuit. After Aiden complained, the waiter removed the burger and promised a new one would be made in its place, the lawsuit states. Lopes' daughter finished one order of fries, then ordered another. According to the lawsuit, 5 minutes after placing the second order, she went to the bathroom and began vomiting. The family rushed her home. The complaint states that the girl developed a rash on her face, arms, and chest, and that her throat tightened, causing breathing difficulties and lightheadedness. The mother injected her with epinephrine and called 911. The lawsuit does not mention what allergen caused the reaction. Lopes' daughter was rushed to Boston Children's Hospital, where she received treatment and was monitored for several hours, according to the complaint. A statement of damages lists $3,788 in hospital expenses. The 110 Grill chain, which has more than 35 locations in New England and New York, advertises its recognition by Allergy Eats as one of the top 10 allergy-aware restaurant brands. A section of the chain's website, titled Allergy Commitment, lists ingredients, food preparation, and employee training as contributing to 110 Grill's allergen-aware reputation, which the lawsuit lists as the reason the family chose to eat at the restaurant in the first place. The complaint states that the girl believed she was going to die during her terrifying anaphylactic reaction and that the traumatic experience worsened a pre-existing eating disorder and food-related anxiety, causing her to lose trust in the safety of her environment and food. According to the complaint, Lopes formerly worked for 110 Grill and is acquainted with the owner. Lopes says she reached out to the owner and received one message in reply, but since has been unable to reach him. Laurel Francoeur, Lopes' attorney, recently filed a similar but unrelated lawsuit in Bristol County on behalf of a woman who allegedly refused service at Chipotle after informing the staff of her allergies. People with food allergies deserve to be treated with respect, Francoeur said in a news release. A representative of 110 Grill did not respond to a request for comment via email. The story, Holmes begins 11-year term in Theranos case. Founder who oversaw blood testing hoax reports to prison. Theranos founder Elizabeth Holmes entered a Texas prison Tuesday, where she could spend the next 11 years for overseeing a blood testing hoax that became a parable about greed and hubris in Silicon Valley. Holmes, 39, could be seen from outside the prison's gates, walking into the federal women's prison camp located in Bryan, Texas, wearing jeans, a brown sweater, and smiling as she spoke with two prison employees accompanying her. The minimum security facility, where the federal judge who sentenced Holmes in November recommended she be incarcerated, is about 95 miles northwest of Houston, where she grew up aspiring to become a technology visionary along the lines of Apple co-founder Steve Jobs. As she begins her sentence, Holmes is leaving behind two young children, a son born July 2021, a few weeks before the start of her trial, and a 3-month-old daughter who was conceived after a jury convicted her on 4 felony counts of fraud and conspiracy in January 2022. She was freed on bail up until Tuesday, most recently living in the San Diego area with the children's father, William Billy Evans. The couple met in 2017 around the same time Holmes was under investigation for the collapse of Theranos, a startup she founded after dropping out of Stanford University when she was just 19. While she was building up Theranos, Holmes grew closer to Ramesh Sunny Balwani, who would become her romantic partner, as well as an investor and fellow executive in the Palo Alto, California company. Together, Holmes and Balwani promised Theranos would revolutionize healthcare with a technology that could quickly scan for diseases and other problems with a few drops of blood taken with a finger prick. The hype surrounding that purported breakthrough helped Theranos raise nearly $1 billion from enthralled investors, assemble an influential board of directors that include former presidential cabinet members George Shultz, Henry Kissinger, and James Mattis, and turned Holmes into a Silicon Valley sensation with a fortune valued at $4.5 billion on paper in 2014. But it all blew up after serious dangerous flaws in Theranos' technology were exposed in a series of explosive articles in the Wall Street Journal that Holmes and Balwani tried to thwart. Holmes and Balwani, who had been secretly living together while running Theranos, broke up after the journal's revelations and the company collapsed. In 2018, the U.S. Justice Department charged both with a litany of white-collar crimes in a case aimed at putting a stop to the Silicon Valley practice of overselling the capabilities of a still-developing technology, a technique that became known as fake it till you make it. Holmes admitted making mistakes at Theranos, but steadfastly denied committing crimes during 7 often fascinating days of testimony on the witness stand during her trial. At one point, she told the jury about being sexually and emotionally abused by Balwani while he controlled her in ways that she said clouded her thinking. Balwani's attorney steadfastly denied Holmes's allegations, which was one of the key reasons they were tried separately. Balwani, 57, was convicted on 12 felony counts of fraud and conspiracy in a trial that began 2 months after Holmes's ended. He is currently serving a nearly 13-year sentence in a Southern California prison. Maintaining she was treated unfairly during the trial, Holmes sought to remain free while she appeals her conviction, but that bid was rejected by U.S. District Judge Edward Davila, who presided over her trial, and the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, leaving her no other avenue left to follow but the one that will take her to prison nearly 20 years after she founded Theranos. Attorneys representing Holmes did not immediately respond when contacted by the Associated Press for a statement on Tuesday. FPC Bryan, a minimum security prison camp located, encompasses about 37 acres of land and houses about 650 women, including Real Housewives of Salt Lake City star Jennifer Shaw, who was sentenced earlier this year to 6.5 years in prison for defrauding thousands of people in a years-long telemarketing scam. Most federal prison camps don't even have fences and house those the Bureau of Prisons considers to be the lowest security risk. The prison camps also have minimal staffing, and many of the people incarcerated there work at prison jobs. The story, Future of Brown Tatum in Spotlight. The Boston Celtics began their season in chaos. They ended it confronted with a decision that could shape the franchise for years to come. Pain, disbelief, and uncertainty hung with the Celtics as they walked off the court following their Eastern Conference Finals Game 7 loss to Miami, ending their attempt to return to the NBA Finals. The matchup with the Heat highlighted all the imperfections of a Boston team that seemingly never recovered after having its season turned on its edge following the suspension of former coach Ime Udoka just days before training camp, when he was given a years-long suspension for having an inappropriate relationship with a woman in the organization. That was an adjustment, Celtic star Jason Tatum said. We all figured it out. Obviously, we wanted to win the championship. Didn't happen. There are the usual questions about the roster heading into the offseason, and other ones like whether intern-termed full-time coach Joe Mazzulla is the right person to lead the Celtics as they try to capitalize on their championship window. But the most pressing revolves around Boston's two biggest stars in Tatum and Jaylen Brown. The 24-year-old Tatum is signed for the next two seasons, still under his rookie extension that kicked in last season. He won't be eligible for a Supermax extension until the summer of 2024. It would start in 2025-26 and could be worth more than $300 million. Brown, 26, is eligible for a new deal this offseason, and by virtue of making the All-Star, All-NBA second team this season, could be offered as much as a five-year contract extension worth as much as $295 million. The league's new collective bargaining agreement bringing more limitations on how teams construct their rosters and additional luxury tax penalties, it may be a commitment the Celtics aren't willing to make for a duo that hasn't yet brought Boston a title. During the regular season, Brown averaged career highs in points, 26.6, rebounds, 6.9, and assists, 3.5. But each of those numbers dipped in the playoffs, and with Tatum reeling from an ankle sprain he sustained on the first play of Game 7, Brown had a disastrous night. He scored 19 points but shot just 8 of 23 from the field with 8 turnovers. It left any thoughts about his future in the immediate aftermath after his Monday's loss the furthest thing from his mind. "We failed. I failed," Brown said. "It's hard to think about anything else right now. To be honest, we'll cross that bridge when we get there." Asked about his thought process entering this summer, he said that also is foggy at this point. "I don't even really know how to answer that question right now," Brown said. "My thought process is to take it one day at a time, focus on getting better, focus on what the future holds, and see where we are from there." For his part, Tatum said he'd like to see the front office keep together a tandem that has made it to at least the conference finals in 4 of its 6 seasons together. "It's extremely important," Tatum said. "He's one of the best players in this league, plays both ends of the ball, and is still relatively young, and he's accomplished a lot so far in his career. So I think it's extremely important." There was a vote of confidence from the locker room for Mazzulla, who led the team to a 57-win season, but he did struggle in the playoffs to make game plan and in-game adjustments. It contributed to extended series in the first two rounds and Boston's 3-0 deficit in the conference finals. Tatum said it shouldn't diminish the job he did throughout the season. "It was his first year. We got to the conference finals game 7, Tatum said. "We all figured it out. Obviously, we wanted to win the championship. Didn't happen. But I think Joe did a great job. We won 50-some-odd games. We got to the Game 7 conference finals. Obviously, everybody can be better, learn from this, but I think Joe did a great job this year. The team's resilience to make the run, it did despite the challenges it dealt with at the start of the season, is what Mazzulla will take away. What do we have to do to get better, I think, is what we have to learn from that," he said. The story, Heat, Nuggets set to square off in the NBA Finals. "Cancel that flight plan, Denver. Turns out the NBA Finals are starting in the Mile High City after all. And Jimmy Butler was proven right. Finally, we have a title series matchup. The Miami Heat, champions of the Eastern Conference, even after getting in as only the number 8 seed, will take on the Western Conference champion Nuggets in Game 1 of the NBA Finals. The series starts in Denver on Thursday night. The The Heat got there by winning Game 7 of the East title series in Boston on Monday night. It came 1 year to the day after the Celtics won a Game 7 on Miami's floor to win the East title a year ago. Next year we will have enough, and we're going to be right back in the same situation, and we're going to get it done, Butler vowed that night. The Heat made those words prophetic. The Nuggets had a flight to Boston tentatively scheduled for Tuesday afternoon, just in case they would be facing the Celtics, who would have had home court advantage in the title series. But the Heat had other ideas, won the deciding game to avoid becoming the first team in NBA history to fall after claiming a 3-0 series lead, and Nikola Jokic and the Nuggets now await. The Heat are in the finals for the 7th time and seeking their 4th championship. The Nuggets are in the finals for the first time in franchise history. When we wake up tomorrow morning, we know who we're playing, Nuggets coach Michael Malone said Monday, a few hours before the Celtics and Heat tipped off in Game 7. We know who we're preparing for, and we can kind of turn the page and really focus in on that. The Eastern Conference Finals has been a hell of a series. Malone will try to win an NBA title for the first time, and if Denver prevails, he'll become the 36th coach in league history to win a championship. Miami's Eric Spoelstra is seeking his 3rd title as a head coach. If he wins it, he'd join only Phil Jackson, Red Auerbach, Heat President Pat Riley, John Kundla, Greg Popovich, and Steve Kerr as 3-time champion coaches. Denver hasn't faced any real trouble yet in these playoffs. The Nuggets are 12-3 in the playoffs, winners of their last 6 games, and grabbed control of their matchups against Minnesota in Round 1, Phoenix in Round 2, and the Lakers in the West Finals right away. 2-time MVP Jokic averaged a triple-double against both the Suns and the Lakers and enters these finals averaging 29.9 points, 13.3 rebounds, and 10.3 assists per game. One of his signature moves of late has been pointing to his ring finger while looking at his family. He's now 4 wins away from the piece of jewelry he wants most. Nikola is still a humble, selfless person, and he cares about home, he cares about family, he cares about his horses. The guy is just who he is, Malone said. I couldn't have more respect for him as a man because of that. A week ago, Miami was in position to do what Denver did, get to the finals with a sweep. It's almost like the Heat forgot they were a 44-38 team that needed 2 play-in games just to get into the playoffs. They ousted number 1 overall seed Milwaukee in Round 1, got past New York in Round 2, and then avenged last season's loss to Boston in the East Finals by somehow going into the Celtics' home floor and winning a Game 7 to avoid the permanent stench of being the first team in NBA history to waste a 3-0 series lead. Sometimes you have to suffer for the things that you really want, Spoelstra said, and this group has shown fortitude. We still have more to do. It was a hellish week for certain, but the Heat got there just as the 2nd number 8 seed to ever make the finals. Everybody rallied around each other, Heat center Bam Adebayo said. Miami has 3 players with championships. Udonis Haslem has been part of 3 Heat titles. Kevin Love won a championship with Cleveland, and Kyle Lowry got a ring with Toronto. The Nuggets have 1 champion on their roster. Denver's Kentavious Caldwell-Pope got 1 with the Lakers. At the NBA's restart bubble in 2020 against the Heat, also back from that Heat Finals team, Butler, Adebayo, Duncan Robinson, Tyler Hero, and Gabe Vincent, the only Denver player besides Caldwell-Pope with Finals experience is Jeff Green, who played in the title series alongside Love with Cleveland in 2018. So most players will be seeking their first ring. Haslem is trying to end his career with a 4th, and Lowry is among the lucky few who are trying to smudge the Larry O'Brien trophy for the 2nd time.
This is the Talking Information Center, a window to independence through local volunteers reading over 300 newspapers, magazines, and books specific to your community.
Now available on your smart speaker by saying, "Play radio station, Talking Information Center."
For comments and more information, call 781-834-4400 or visit ticnetwork.org.
Thank you for listening.
WBBF Middleborough, WRRS Middleborough, WRRSLP Pittsfield, WLLA Londonderry, WVALLP FL, WDJM Framingham.
Coming up next from the Talking Information Center, news stories from the Taunton Daily Gazette.
This is Pamela Ann Peters for the Talking Information Center, reading the Taunton Daily Gazette. Little dog, big job. The Taunton Police Department has a brand new four-legged employee, Maggie the Comfort Dog, or Make That Puppy. Maggie, a nine-week-old golden retriever, arrived at the Taunton Police Department in early May from Golden Opportunities for Independence in Walpole, and she already has her own Instagram and Facebook pages. The adorable little employee's arrival perfectly corresponded with Mental Health Awareness Month, which takes place in the month of May. We are excited to welcome Maggie to our department, where she will work alongside our mental health co-response clinician to provide comfort and support to those in crisis, Taunton Police Chief Ed Walsh said. Police departments across the nation are welcoming comfort dogs into their ranks, and the feedback has truly been amazing. We hope that Maggie will help to bridge connections between our department and the public, while simultaneously being a calming presence to all. What will Maggie's training and duties be? Maggie will be partnered with the Taunton Police co-response clinician Katrina Lee. Together, Maggie and Lee will be attending Golden Opportunities for Independence's Community Resource Dog Training Program. Once they graduate, Maggie will help with de-escalation and provide comfort to those who may be experiencing or have experienced trauma during mental health calls for service, the written statement said. Comfort dogs have been shown to reduce stress, anxiety, and feelings of loneliness. They can also serve as a calming presence in times of crisis or trauma. Maggie was named after Taunton's PD's first female officer. Members of the Taunton Police Department voted on several names. The name Maggie was chosen in honor of the department's first female officer. In 1943, Margaret Stevens was appointed as the department's first policewoman and went on to become a senior officer before retiring in 1962. Chief Walsh and members of the Taunton Police Department would like to thank all community partners who supported Maggie so far, especially Mayor Shauna O'Connell's office. How to keep up with Maggie's adventures? Community members can keep up with Maggie's adventures on Instagram and Facebook. On those platforms, followers can expect adorable photos, information about community events, and resources for mental health, addiction, domestic violence, social services, and more. Top 11 earners at Bridgewater Rainham School District. Which employees for the Bridgewater Rainham Regional School District made the most in fiscal year 2022-2023? The Gazette analyzed salary data provided by the district. Like previous years, the highest earners are typically those part of the administration or at the executive level positions in the schools. The top 100 earners in the district all made more than $108,000 annually. The district reported a little over 900 total employees on the district's payroll, whether full-time, part-time, or temporary staff. There was a four-way tie among several employees, so here are the top 11 highest earners for Bridgewater Rainham Regional School District for 2022-2023. 1. Derek J. Swenson, former superintendent, $178,555. 2. Kathleen A. Macedo, director of business services, $159,519. 3. Ryan T. Powers, assistant superintendent, $156,060. 4. Paul Tzvolis, Jr., Director of Student Services, $145,000. 5. Angela M. Watson, Principal, Bridgewater Rainham Regional High School, $144,347. 6. Dennis S. Bray, Principal, George Mitchell Elementary School, $125,488. 7. Galdina Medeiros, Administrator of Special Education, $118,247. 8. William G. O'Connell, Coordinator of Wellness and Athletics, $115,000. 9. Christine F. Richards, Coordinator of Teaching and Learning, $115,000. 10. Michael J. Shantz, IT Manager, $115,000. 11. Deborah A. Westell, Principal, Lily B. Merrill Elementary School, $115,000. Most back college affirmative action. As the Supreme Court decides the fate of affirmative action, most U.S. adults say the court should allow colleges to consider race as part of the admissions process. Yet few believe students' race should ultimately play a major role in decisions, according to a new poll. The May poll from the Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs Research found that 63% say the Supreme Court should not block colleges from considering race or ethnicity in their admission systems. The poll found little divide among political or racial lines. But those polled were more likely to say factors such as grades and standardized test scores should be important, while 68% of adults said race and ethnicity should not be a significant factor. The poll reflects general support for affirmative action, even as the future of the practice remains in doubt. The Supreme Court is expected to rule soon on lawsuits challenging admission systems at Harvard University and the University of North Carolina. With a conservative majority on the court, many college leaders are bracing for a decision that could scale back or eliminate the use of race admission. Americans' views on race and admissions, that it should be permitted but be only a small factor, generally line up with the way colleges say they use it. Many colleges, especially selective ones, say race is one of many factors that officials can weigh when choosing which students get accepted. They say it is not a large influence, but may sometimes give an edge to underrepresented students in close decisions. Colleges defend the practice as a way to bring a wide mix of students to campus, saying racial diversity benefits all students. It's unknown how many colleges consider race admissions, and the practice has been outlawed in 9 states, including California, Michigan, and Florida. Layla Trombley sees it as a matter of fairness. White students have long had the upper hand in admissions because of institutional racism, said Trombley, 47, who is half black. Affirmative action helps even the playing field, she said. It seems like it's hard to get in if you don't have that help, just because we're not traditionally thought of as industrious or smart or hardworking, she said. She said she experienced that kind of bias growing up in a mostly white area. At school, it felt like she was always underestimated, she said. It's under the radar, said Trombley of Cortland, New York, who calls herself politically moderate. It's not said directly, but it's implied, like, you're really good at this, but why don't you try this? In Roswell, Georgia, Andrew Holko also says colleges should be allowed to factor race in admissions decisions. He sees it as a tool to offset imbalances in America's public schools, where those in wealthy, white areas tend to get more money from taxes and parent groups than those in black neighborhoods. He sees that happen in areas like nearby Cobb County, where schools in the predominantly black southern end of the county are poorer than those in white areas of the suburban Atlantic County. They don't have computers to study with, said Holko, 49, who is white and describes himself as politically independent. They don't have tutoring services available. He added, affirmative action is necessary to overcome those disparities. In Holko's view, race should be a factor of high importance to make sure college campuses reflect the racial makeup of their communities. Among all Americans, 13% said they think race should be a very or extremely important part of the admission process, according to the poll, while 18% said it should be somewhat important. Black and Hispanic adults were the most likely to say it should be at least very important. The poll found similar views when it comes to considering gender admissions. 9% of adults said it should be very important, 14% somewhat important, and 77% not very or not at all important. Men and women shared similar views on the race, on the role of gender. By contrast, 62% of Americans think high school grades should be very important, while 30% said they should be somewhat important. Nearly half said standardized test scores should be very important. To Jana Winston, college admissions should be a matter of merit and nothing more. Students should be based on their grades, test scores, and extracurricular activities. I don't think race should have anything in the world to do with it, said Winston of Batesburg-Leesville, who is half white and half Cherokee. Giving a preference to students of certain races is unfair to others who are just as academically qualified, she said. There's a lot of kids that work really, really hard, and I don't like the idea of being pushed out of the way just because the college feels they need to do something politically correct, said Winston, 50, a self-described political moderate who works at Walmart. The Supreme Court has upheld affirmative action decisions reaching back to 1978. The lawsuits at Harvard and UNC accused those students of discriminating against white and Asian students. Lower courts upheld admission systems at both schools. Many colleges also consider athletics when reviewing applicants, but the poll found that most Americans said it should have very little influence. Just 9% say athletic ability should be very important, while 29% say it should be somewhat important. Similarly, few think family ties should be much of a factor. Just 9% said it should be very important that a family member attend the school, and 18% said it should be somewhat important. Views were similar when it came to students whose families had donated to the university, with just 10% saying donations should be highly important. The practice of giving a boost to children of alumni, known as legacy preference, has come under criticism in recent years from critics who say it favors wealthy and white students. Some prominent schools have abandoned it, such as Amherst College and Johns Hopkins University. If the Supreme Court strikes down affirmative action, some education experts think more colleges will follow suit and drop legacy preferences to remove an obstacle for students of color. Ex-Theranos CEO Holmes enters Texas prison to begin sentenced. Disgraced Theranos CEO Elizabeth Holmes is in custody at a Texas prison where she could spend the next 11 years for overseeing a blood testing hoax that became a parable about greed and hubris in Silicon Valley, according to the Federal Bureau of Prisons. Holmes, 39, on Tuesday entered a federal women's prison camp in Bryan. The minimum security facility is about 95 miles northwest of Houston, where Holmes grew up aspiring to become a technology visionary along the lines of Apple co-founder Steve Jobs. Maintaining she was treated unfairly during the trial, Holmes sought to remain free while she appeals her conviction. But that bid was rejected by U.S. District Judge Edward Davila, who presided over her trial, and the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, leaving her no other avenue left to follow but the one that will take her to prison nearly 20 years after she founded Theranos. Ex-Trump White House official to go on trial in September. Former Trump White House official Peter Navarro will stand trial in September on a contempt of Congress charges filed after he refused to cooperate with a congressional investigation into the January 6 attack on the U.S. Capitol. U.S. District Judge Amit Mehta set a September 5th trial date during a court appearance on Tuesday in Washington. Navarro was charged last year with one contempt count for failing to appear for a deposition before the House Committee investigating the January 6 attack, and a second charge for failing to produce documents the committee requested. He has pleaded not guilty. Mayor, 5 missing in Iowa collapse. 5 people remain unaccounted for including two people whose remains may be in a pile of rubble at the site of a partially collapsed apartment building, officials of the city of Davenport, Iowa, said Tuesday. Mayor Mike Mattson confirmed the numbers at a news conference following criticism that the city was moving too quickly toward demolishing the building before making sure that no one is still inside. Protests erupted after a woman was rescued Monday night, hours after the city ordered the demolition to begin as early as Tuesday. A family member of one of the missing people also spoke, pleading with people to understand that authorities want to bring the remains of the six-story building down in a controlled way without dumping more material into the rubble pile. The building is unstable and continues to worsen as time progresses, Fire Marshal James Morris said. It's the opinion of the structural engineer that any additional search operations in the area of that pile of debris should be avoided due to potential collapse. We are currently evaluating the risk assessment of where we can go back to that building to do this other research. We're very sympathetic to the possibility that there's two people still left inside, Morris said as he fought back tears. Protesters carried signs Tuesday morning near the building site saying, "Find them first," and "Who is in the rubble?" Some used a megaphone to shout out names of building residents. City officials said rescue crews escorted 12 people from the building shortly after a middle section collapsed at about 5 p.m. Sunday and rescued several others, including one person who was taken to safety overnight Sunday. By Monday morning, Fire Chief Michael Carlston told reporters no known individuals are trapped in that facility. Authorities said they would soon shift from a rescue operation to a recovery operation. The city then issued a statement saying that the owner had been served with an order for demolition that was expected to begin Tuesday morning. That prompted many people to turn to Facebook, naming loved ones who were unaccounted for, and expressing concern that the building was being demolished too quickly. On Tuesday morning, the city issued a new statement saying it has been continually evaluating the timing of the demolition. The statement said demolition is a multi-phase process that includes permitting and staging of equipment that will begin today. The timing of the physical demolition of the property is still being evaluated. The building remains structurally secure and in imminent danger of collapse. The woman was rescued about 8 p.m. on Monday after calling her family for help, according to multiple news reports. A bystander's video showed someone waving from a fourth-floor window to a fire department ladder truck below. A city statement late Monday said an injured woman had been extricated, but it wasn't immediately clear if this was the same person referred to in news reports. Authorities did not immediately respond to a message seeking comment. When firefighters initially arrived Sunday, they immediately took action, saving lives at great risk to their personal safety, city officials said. There was a lot of screams, a lot of cries, a lot of people saying help when the building came down, Tad Mashevic, a resident of the building, told KCCI-TV. But that did not last, and 2 or 3 minutes, and then the whole area was silent. Carlson said the back of the complex had separated from the front rest of the building, and authorities found a gas leak. It wasn't clear what immediately caused the collapse, which left a gaping hole in the center of what was once the Davenport Hotel, a building listed in the National Register of Historic Places in 1983. Built in 1907, the brick over steel and concrete structure had been renovated into a mixed-use building with residential and commercial spaces. Work was being done on the building's exterior at the time of the collapse, said Rich Oswald, the city's director of development and neighborhood services. Reports of falling bricks were part of that work, and the building's owner had a permit for the project, Oswald said. Governor Kim Reynolds issued a disaster proclamation for Scott County, activating the Iowa Individual Assistance Grant Program and the Disaster Case Management Program for the residents left homeless. The property owners were served Monday with a demolition order, and the residents were prevented from going back inside to remove their belongings due to the building's unstable condition. Authorities confirmed Then multiple residents had complained of unmet maintenance problems. Quad City Times reported nearly 20 permits were filed in 2022, mainly for plumbing or electrical issues, according to the county assessor's office. The collapse did not surprise Shalon Murray, former resident, who told the Associated Press that his one-year stay there was a nightmare. Murray, 46, moved into his apartment in February 2022 and almost immediately began having issues. The heat and air conditioner didn't work, and there were plumbing problems in the bathroom. Multiple calls to the management company rarely got a response. And when a maintenance person did stop by, they never completely fixed the problems, he said. They would come in and put some caulk on it, he said, but it needed more than that. They didn't fix stuff, they just patched it up. He questions how the building passed inspections. It was horrible, Murray said. Murray said he moved out a month before his lease was up in March and still hasn't received his security deposit. Despite deplorable conditions, many residents were like him, he said, struggling to come up with the first and last month's rent plus security deposit required to move elsewhere. Biden works to rally debt deal support. President Joe Biden says he feels good about the debt ceiling and budget deal negotiated with House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, as the White House and congressional leaders work to ensure its passage this week in time to lift the nation's borrowing limit and prevent a disastrous U.S. default. Biden spent part of the Memorial Day holiday calling lawmakers in both parties, as the president does his part to deliver the votes. A number of hard right conservatives are criticizing the deal as falling short of the deep spending cuts they wanted, while liberals decry policy changes such as new work requirements for older Americans in the food aid program. A key test was to come Tuesday afternoon, when the House Rules Committee was scheduled to consider the package and vote on sending it to the full House for a vote expected Wednesday. "I feel very good about it," Biden told reporters Monday as he left Washington for his home in Delaware. "I spoke to a number of the members," he said, among them Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell, a past partner in big bipartisan deals who largely sat this one out. "I spoke to a whole bunch of people, and it feels good," Biden said. To those progressive Democrats raising concerns about the package, the president had a simple message. Talk to me. As lawmakers size up the 99-page bill, few are expected to be fully satisfied with the final product. But Biden, a Democrat, and McCarthy, a Republican, are counting on pulling majority to support from the political center, a rarity in divided Washington, to join in voting to prevent a catastrophic federal default. McCarthy acknowledged the hard-fought compromise with Biden will not be 100% of what everybody wants, as he leads a slim House majority powered by hard right conservatives. Facing potential blowback from his conservative ranks, the Republican speaker will have to rely on upward of half the House Democrats and half the House Republicans to push the debt ceiling package to passage. Overall, the package is a trade-off that would impose some spending reductions for the next 2 years, along with the suspension of the debt limit into January 2025, pushing the volatile political issue past the next presidential election. Raising the debt limit, now $31 trillion, would allow Treasury to continue borrowing to pay the nation's already incurred bills. Additionally, policy issues are raising the most objections from lawmakers. Liberal lawmakers fought hard, but were unable to stop new work requirements for people 50 to 54 who receive government food assistance and are otherwise able-bodied without dependents. The Republicans demand the bolstered work requirements as part of the deal, but some say the changes to food stamp program are not enough. The Republicans were also pushing to beef up work requirements for health care and other aid. Biden refused to go along on those. Questions are also being raised about an unexpected provision that essentially gives congressional approval to Mountain Valley Pipeline, a natural gas project important to Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat, West Virginia, that many Democrats and others oppose. At the same time, conservative Republicans, including those from the White House Freedom Caucus, say the budget slashing does not go nearly far enough to have their support. "No one claiming to be conservative could justify a yes vote," tweeted Representative Bob Good, Republican, Virginia. This deal is insanity, said Representative Ralph Norman, Republican, South Carolina. Not going to vote to bankrupt our country. All told, the package would hold spending essentially flat for the coming year, while allowing increases for military and veterans accounts. It would cap growth at 1% for 2025. The House Rules Committee has three members from the influential Freedom Caucus who may very well try to block the package from advancing, forcing McCarthy to rely on the Democrats on the pound to ensure the bill can be sent to the House floor. The House aims to vote Wednesday and send the bill to the Senate, where Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, along with McConnell, are working for a quick passage by week's end. Senators, who have remained largely on the sidelines during much of the negotiations between the President and the House Speaker, began inserting themselves more forcefully into the debate. Some senators are insisting on amendments to reshape the package from both the left and right flanks. That could require time-consuming debates that delay final approval of the deal. Democratic Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia is extremely disappointed by the provision greenlining the controversial Mountain Valley Pipeline, his office said in a statement. He plans to file an amendment to remove the provision from the package. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina complained that the military spending increases are not enough. I will use all power available to me in the Senate to have amendment votes undo this catastrophe for defense, he tweeted. But making any changes to the package at this stage seems highly unlikely with so little time to spare. Congress and the White House are racing to meet the Monday deadline, now less than a week away. That's when Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has said the U.S. would run short of cash and face an unprecedented debt default without action. A default would almost certainly crush the U.S. economy and spill over around the globe, as the world's reliance on stability of the American dollar and the country's leadership falls into question. That's all the time we have for News for Today. This has been Pamela Ann Peters reading the Taunton Daily Gazette.
You've just heard news stories from the Taunton Daily Gazette. Please stay tuned for more programming. Newton's Carroll Center for the Blind, one of the largest vision rehabilitation agencies in the nation, will host its 11th annual Walk for Independence on Saturday, June 3rd, from 8 a.m. to noon. It's a family-friendly event, bringing together both sighted and visually impaired individuals to support the nonprofit organization's mission. Walkers can choose either a 1, 2, or 3 mile stroll around the Mount Ida campus of UMass Amherst, located at 100 Carlson Avenue in Newton. And then stay for complimentary food, music, accessible games, and fun giveaways. Guide dogs and family pets on leashes are welcome. Individuals and teams can register at www.carol.org/walk. That's www.carroll.org/walk.
Hi, this is John Ondrasik of Five for Fighting, here for RAD, the entertainment industry's voice for road safety. You know, style is a personal thing, and your lifestyle is your business. But if you take it on the road, it becomes everybody's business. So please, plan ahead, designate before you celebrate. Friends, don't let friends drive drunk.
A public service announcement brought to you by RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
My name is Dale Pazinski. I'm 19 years old, and this is how I live United. I've always been kind of a computer geek, and I found a way to use those skills to help the homeless in my community. For people facing hard times, computer skills and a basic resume are so important. It may seem like a small thing, but it makes a huge difference in people's lives. So with United Way, I created a program where I work with the homeless. Together, we go through their whole job history, write a resume, and then save it on the very own USB drive. We provide workbooks and training certificates. I even budgeted for cupcakes so we can celebrate as a class when one of our people gets a job. That's huge. When somebody says, "Hey man, bad job that you helped me apply for? I got it." That's what living united feels like to me. My name is Dale Pazinski. I help people achieve financial independence. So I don't just wear the shirt, I live it.
Give, advocate, volunteer, live united. Go to liveunited.org, brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
This is the Talking Information.